My Govanan, welcome to the Tolkien Lore Channel. I'm the Tolkien Geek, and in this video, I'm going to be once again comparing Tolkien to some more modern culture, and in particular, this time, I am talking about the movie Inside Out, which is a great movie all unto itself. It actually makes me cry every time I watch it, so I really enjoy the movie. But my kids were watching it recently, and the thought occurred to me that it actually dovetails nicely with an idea that I had for a video for quite a while now and never really had a good way to put it, you know, into a format that would actually be good for a video. And this kind of finalized my thought process on it. And that is the whole idea in Tolkien of sorrow leading to wisdom and the idea of pity being, you know, very connected to that and some other things. And this kind of starts with some of the stuff in the Silmarillion, because when in the Silmarillion we get to the second chapter, which is the Valaquinta, and Tolkien is describing the, you know, the various Valar and some of the lesser spirits, the Maiar. He talks about Nienna, and Nienna is supposed to be like one of the really great ones, but all she does is cry. You know, that's kind of the way that Corey Olson puts it sometimes, is like, she just cries. Like, what does she do? So there's this idea that she's this really great being among the Valar, but what does she actually do? What is significant about her role? And there's very little we get in terms of Nienna, in terms of the story, and most of it comes in the Valaquinta itself, except for when she waters the mound of Azelohar with her own tears, both in order to help the trees grow and in order to try to revive them after they've been poisoned by Ungoliant. Besides that, we get very little about her anywhere. But there are a few passages in the Valaquinta which are pretty significant and which have always kind of grabbed my attention as this has to be significant somehow, and I don't know how. So I want to read a couple of these passages, and there will be some other passages that are pertinent to this discussion as well. The first one is when it's talking about Nienna herself. It says, "Mightier than Este is Nienna, sister of the Faonturi. She dwells alone." Now, for those of you not familiar, the Faonturi are Lorien and Mondos, better known by their proper, or less well known, actually, by their proper names, Irmo and Namo. Lorien is kind of the Vala associated with dreams and inspiration and that sort of thing. Mondos, of course, is sort of the god of the dead, sort of like the Hades of Tolkien's universe, in a sense. So she is their sister, and it says that she dwells alone. "She is acquainted with grief and mourns for every wound that Arda has suffered in the marring of Melkor. So great was her sorrow as the music unfolded that her song turned to lamentation long before its end, and the sound of mourning was woven into the themes of the world before it began. But she does not weep for herself, and those who hearken to her learn pity and endurance in hope. Her halls are west of west, upon the borders of the world, and she comes seldom to the city of Valimar, where all is glad. She goes rather to the halls of Mondos, which are near to her own, and all those who wait in Mondos cry to her, for she brings strength to spirit, and turns sorrow to wisdom." So there's not a lot of words there, but there are some significant points, like the fact that those who hearken to her learn pity, that her, you know, her song turned to lamentation, and therefore sorrow was kind of a part, or mourning was part of the world before it began. The whole idea of endurance and hope, and those who cry to her, you know, she brings strength to the spirit and turns sorrow to wisdom. And the sorrow to wisdom bit is the part that always kind of piqued my interest. How does sorrow turn to wisdom? How does that work? What does that look like? And Tolkien never gets very explicit with this idea, but it is there occasionally. One example of this, and again, it doesn't really get explicit in terms of how it works exactly, but when Aragorn is tending to people in the Houses of Healing after the Battle of the Pelennor Fields is over, he starts tending to Merry, and he ends up saying, he's talking to Pippin here, "Do not be afraid," said Aragorn, "I came in time, and I have called him back. He is weary now and grieved, and he has taken a hurt like the Lady Eowyn, daring to smite that deadly thing. But these evils can be amended, so strong and gay a spirit is in him. His grief he will not forget, but it will not darken his heart. It will teach him wisdom." Now, specifically, the grief that he's talking about here, it's not clear if he's talking about the grief he suffered from the wound, which is not exactly a physical wound, or the grief of Theoden dying, which was spoken about just before the passage that I just read. But Aragorn here is repeating this idea of the grief leading to wisdom and not darkening his heart. So that idea gets carried through, and there are places, I think, in Tolkien's stories where that idea is kind of embedded, but you have to know where to look for it and really dig it out. One example of that might be Turin's entire life, because Turin is basically a hothead who is prone to pity. And it's as he loses his ability to pity that he gets worse and worse and worse. And his pity, perhaps, is what could have given him a little more wisdom and maybe saved him if he had, you know, leaned a little more heavily towards that rather than his hot-headed brashness. But that's, you know, a really deep discussion all on its own. And there's probably other places in Tolkien where you can find this idea too. But again, it's usually buried really deep. The other major passage from the Silmarillion, which is also in the Vala Quinta, is when we get to some of the Maiar. And it says, "Wisest of the Maiar was Olorin." And of course, those of you who are in the know that Olorin is actually Gandalf. Gandalf is what he's known as in the north of Middle-earth, but Olorin is his name among the Maiar and the elves that would have known him as a Maia in Valinor. "He too dwelt in Lorien, but his ways took him often to the house of Nienna, and of her he learned pity and patience." There again is that idea of pity and patience, which is at least somewhat connected to the idea of endurance and hope. And of course, Olorin, or Gandalf, one of the things that we learn about him, too, is that he tends to inspire those around him. That's kind of like his special gift. He is often kind of in the background, not really, you know, present in a way that anybody would notice, but he inspires those who are nearby with ideas. And it says in the Silmarillion that, you know, the elves that were, you know, kind of inspired by him, didn't know where this inspiration really came from, but that he was doing this. And we see him acting in this capacity in The Lord of the Rings all the time. And we also get the whole idea of Círdan giving him the Ring of Fire, specifically giving him the idea that that ring would help him kindle courage in others' hearts. So again, that idea of inspiration. Like, this is really Gandalf's role. His idea is to spur others to do what they're supposed to do, not just be the man of action out in front doing all the work for everybody else. So this idea of him inspiring others is really kind of connected to this whole thing too. And it all has a very amorphous sense of it all tying together, but again, it's not really clear how it works. But I was, as my kids were watching Inside Out, and I was of course kind of watching it piecemeal, I was doing chores around the house and things like that, well, not just sitting there watching it with them, but of course I know the story and I know how it goes, and there were bits and pieces that I watched kind of all the way through. And the, you know, one of the main lessons, if you haven't seen this movie, is that being sad is okay. I know that sounds like a weird thing to have to say, but that actually is kind of the message of the movie. It's okay to be sad, and it's okay to show that you're sad. And the key scene where this really comes out is where joy, like the whole movie, if you're not familiar, centers around five emotions who are kind of like the controllers for this little girl in the, you know, our world, so to speak. They're like her primary emotions that drive her actions. And her, everybody in this movie has kind of their own set of these five emotions. It's joy, sadness, fear, anger, and disgust. Well, everybody has their own kind of head emotion. Like, her dad's main emotion is anger, and her main emotion is joy. So joy, as her main emotion, who's kind of the leader of her little group of emotions, is constantly trying to make sure that she is happy all the time and not ever really sad. And this becomes a problem because at one point she starts to break down and become really sad. And it's, you know, sadness is taking her role in, like, doing what really she's kind of supposed to do, but Joy thinks that she's ruining everything by making her sad. And due to Joy's actions in trying to prevent some of this stuff, things go awry. Joy and Sadness end up outside the command center of the brain, off on this big adventure. And they end up in this one scene where another character is really unhappy. Joy, true to her nature, tries to cheer up this character by just being happy, goofy, whatever, and it's accomplishing nothing at all. Sadness comes along and sits down next to him and just kind of quietly grieves with him and sympathizes, and it makes him feel better. Shortly after this, they're all together, you know, they're all traveling together still, and they end up knocking over a bag of memories, basically, is what it is. It's memories, and some memories end up in the memory dump where they get forgotten and some don't, but they've got this bag of memories that gets knocked over, or maybe it's a box, I don't remember, but anyway, these memories spill out and they start looking at them, and Joy picks up one that's colored yellow for a happy memory, whereas sad memories are blue, you know, angry memories are red, whatever. She picks it up and, you know, she's talking about how she remembers this particular memory and likes it a lot because all the team kind of came around and, you know, made the main girls, you know, her, whatever, really happy for whatever the circumstance was. Sadness says, yeah, I like that memory too. And Joy thinks, oh, good, you're, you know, like, starting to come around and stop being such a, you know, sad, mopey person. And then she explains it's when she missed the winning shot in a hockey game and was all depressed, and that's what led the rest of her team to come over and try to cheer her up. And it finally dawns on Joy, having seen Sadness kind of cheer up this other character by grieving with him, and now seeing how Sadness sees this old memory, which is colored yellow for happy, but had a sad background, that the grieving is a natural thing, and it needs to happen. So the resolution of the movie, of course, basically ends up being they both make it back, and Joy actually lets Sadness do what her job ought to be, and, you know, let the main character girl feel her emotions that she needs to be feeling instead of trying to squash them. And so that's kind of the key lesson of the movie is, you know, it's okay to be sad and it's okay to show that you're sad, because when you do that, other people can actually react in ways that are appropriate to how you feel. It lets them pity you. Now, one of the things that Corey Olson talks about a lot when pity comes up in any of the stuff that he's talking about, you know, exploring Lord of the Rings or whatever, is that in our modern day, we tend to think of pity as being like a condescending type of, you know, feeling or emotion. And it's, you know, we only feel pity for people who are beneath us. And what he likes to point out is, yes, it's condescending in a sense, in that it's they're lesser in the sense that they are in a position of being sad where we're not necessarily, but it's not. That doesn't, you know, it doesn't mean it's condescending in the sense of patronizing or, you know, you're less than me. It's more the idea of, you know, you're in a position that is worse than mine, and I sympathize with that, right? Pity is ultimately, in its truest sense, an expression of sympathy or even empathy. And that's a good thing. That is a natural thing, and it's a very healthy thing, which is what we learn in this movie when, you know, Sadness actually helps somebody feel better, not by just trying to be goofy and trying to cheer him up by completely ignoring what he's feeling, but by acknowledging what he's feeling and grieving with him. Now, this all really kind of comes together because the whole idea of pity here is one of the key things. One of the things that Gandalf or Olorin learns from Nienna is pity and patience. Pity, of course, Gandalf will tell Frodo, is what stayed Bilbo's hand, and may that pity may rule the fate of many. Pity in itself is a sort of wisdom, because pity properly understood, not a Mr. T, I pity the fool type of pity, but rather the kind of pity that you feel for somebody out of genuine empathy or sympathy for that person is wisdom, in that you feeling that for them is acknowledging, yeah, there's something wrong with that, and I wish that it weren't so, and I would like to help you. It is a loving type of emotion. It is the kind of emotion you feel for somebody you care about, and the kind of emotion that can help people in a worse position if they'll accept it. Now, of course, you have Eowyn and her dynamic with Faramir, where she takes the kind of more modern approach where she doesn't want Faramir's pity or Aragorn's pity, because she thinks of that as being like, you're, you know, just treating me like somebody who is lesser and just, you know, only gets your pity. It's like, well, that's... And Faramir tells her, don't scorn pity offered by, you know, a true heart, basically. It's like, don't turn that away. That's a good thing. It's not bad to have that. But Eowyn's culture is such that she doesn't see it that way until Faramir brings her around. And this whole idea of pity being connected with all this ties into the idea of sorrow bringing wisdom in a couple of different ways. One of them is, pity itself is wisdom, but how do you understand to pity unless you yourself have sorrowed, right? You know what it's like to feel bad, therefore you can sympathize with other people who feel bad and pity them. That's how that works. You learn the way the world is because you experience it, and therefore you can also understand other people's positions, even if they're not identical to yours, because they're at least similar enough that you can kind of share in that emotion with them. And it's the sharing of that emotion of sadness, grief, sorrow, that allows people to bond and, you know, kind of rise up out of that. Now, I'm not, you know, trying to make a statement about absolute clinical depression or anything like that. I'm, you know, not going there, but certainly there is a sense in which, you know, if you're feeling down, it's probably going to help you a lot more if your friends and family grieve with you rather than just try to find ways to make you feel better without really acknowledging what's going on at root. And that's, you know, one aspect of the wisdom, I think, that comes from sorrow. The other thing is, learning from your own sorrow is actually a thing. I mean, like, you learn, in a sense, what is true about the world by experiencing sorrow. There's a sense in which, when you experience really deep sadness about something, that's kind of your heart telling you something about this situation is wrong. Now, of course, I'm speaking from Tolkien's worldview here, because Tolkien, being a Catholic, he believed in a creator who created us, you know, to have feelings and rational mind that actually match the world around us. And so from that perspective, the idea there is, when you feel really sad about something, it's probably because that thing is supposed to make you feel sad, which means it's not right. It's not the way the world is supposed to be. And that can teach us things about the world. Now, that's not to say that you should let your emotions guide you in everything. Tolkien wouldn't believe in that either. But there is a sense in which your emotions are a guide to a lot of how you operate in the world, because they do tell you something that is at least partially true. You don't usually get angry at something without feeling like something is unjust, right? Anger tends to be a response to a lack of fairness. Sadness tends to be more of a response to a deprivation of something that is good. You know, you've lost something that is valuable or good. Joy is when you have all of those things. Fear is when something threatens that which you have, which is good. You know, all these different emotions, they actually do play into a rational worldview. You can't just always take it at surface level necessarily, but it's certainly there as a very general guide to, when you feel an emotion about something, probably there's a good reason for it. It's not, you know, necessarily what you may think at, like I said, at a surface level, but if you think about it and analyze it after the fact, you can understand, The reason I'm sad is because of this. So this is probably wrong in some way. You know, it's wrong in the sense that it's somehow off the mark of what the world is supposed to be like. You know, in the Christian worldview, the world is supposed to have been perfect, and then man went and screwed it up by sinning. If that hadn't happened, there wouldn't be the kind of sorrow there is in the world, and there wouldn't be as much cause to be angry, or any cause to be angry. So you have the idea that these emotions tie into the way the world is in a natural, rational way. Now, returning to that idea that Nienna, you know, brings endurance and hope, this is, again, connects to the idea of sorrow and wisdom in that if you've kind of really put all these ideas together in your own head and really, you know, taken them down, analyzed them, not necessarily in like a clinical, cold way, but really understood at least what's going on with these emotions, you get to a point where you realize sorrow is, you know, as a result of something that is not good, but that means there is a good. And if there is a good, and if there is a, you know, a good God who actually gave us those emotions, then that means that good God is going to rectify things like the things that cause sorrow. And therefore, that gives us the hope that then leads to our ability to endure the sorrow. And there again is wisdom, because the idea there is, you know, if I recognize that the world is messed up, if the world is messed up, that means there's got to be something to fix it. In a purely atheistic worldview, the argument would be, from the Christian, of course, that there's no such thing as being a messed up world. It just is what it is. And your sorrow at the way the world is just a reflection of chemical processes in the brain. It doesn't actually mean anything. Which you could even get down to the point of questioning, why do humans even have emotions at all? Like, what's the evolutionary benefit of emotions? Just have, if humans just acted on pure instinct like animals do, you wouldn't need emotions there, per se. You just need, like, the instinctive reaction to a given thing. Like, you get hurt, you instinctively react in a way to either fix what's hurting you or whatever. You don't need to feel depression. You don't need to feel joy. You don't need to feel these things that we think of as emotions. And so the fact that we even have emotions at all is, in some sense, evidence of a designer who gave us the emotions to guide us along the path. Now, again, this is just me saying this is the way the argument would work, right? So the idea is the sorrow can actually lead you to the conclusion that because I recognize the world is messed up, that therefore means there is a fixed version of the world that should exist, Arda Unmarred, or Arda Renewed. And if there's an Arda Renewed, or a fixed world, then there is a person who is going to fix that world, that being God. And that means things will be put right. And therefore, the sorrow can actually lead to that kind of wisdom, again, from Tolkien's point of view. So I think that is an aspect of it as well. As far as what Merry is going to learn from his grief, I'm not sure I have an answer to that one yet. Maybe in a future video. But certainly, I really like the fact that Tolkien is still thinking about these same ideas, you know, all throughout all of his writings, and his characters have all this same kind of stuff going on. Gandalf, of course, fulfills a lot of his purpose by having the kind of pity that Bilbo had. He understands, you know, the kinds of things that the people in Middle-earth are going through, and so he has pity on them. One thing that we can say about Gandalf that is distinct from Saruman is Saruman does not seem to feel pity for anybody. And that's a problem. Saruman is a psychopath. He is devoid of that kind of emotion. And that's what makes Saruman a problem. Because if he felt that way about other people, he would actually probably not have gone the route that he went. But he was proud and arrogant, and he didn't feel pity for others. And this is another aspect of it, too. Pity implies a certain amount of humility. If you have no humility and you're just proud and arrogant, the tendency is not going to be to pity other people, but to scorn them. Because you're going to be like, well, that's your own fault. That's, you know, you're just stupid, or you just made bad decisions, and why didn't you, you know. As opposed to somebody like Gandalf, who recognizes life is hard. You know, none of us are perfect, and it's really hard to do the right thing and make all the right decisions, and therefore it's really, really arrogant to just dismiss somebody else's misfortune and not sympathize with it instead. Gandalf can pity others because he has the humility to recognize it's not that easy. Saruman, being the smart genius that he is, you know, just sees everybody else as idiots and therefore not worth his empathy or sympathy. So again, there's another aspect of this, and you could probably come up with a bunch of other facets to it that give the idea of how sorrow can turn to wisdom and how pity is related to that. And but it's just the more you think about it, the more it kind of unfolds, and it just takes that, you know, it just, in my case, it took watching a Pixar movie, but it, you know, the one little thing can unlock a really deep insight that Tolkien has. And, you know, this is one of those things where I've done several of these where I've compared Tolkien to modern culture in some way or another. I've done, you know, at least two more that I can think of in the past, and I think more than that. And oddly enough, it tends to be the kids' movies that dovetail the best with Tolkien's own themes. It's not necessarily the adult movies that do it. And that tells you something. And this is why Tolkien loved fairy stories. Fairy stories in our world we think of as being for kids. Tolkien knew better. And this is why. When you tell a good story in the form of something like a fairy tale, you can pass on wisdom that is really hard to pass on any other way. And it's really fascinating to watch how that works out in terms of modern culture. It really is sometimes the kids' movies and kids' media, when it's done right, that is honestly the deepest, which is kind of weird to think about. And it's, you know, there's this idea in our modern world that when you grow up, you kind of outgrow what we think of as childish things. And growing up means you get into a bunch of other stuff, which I won't, you know, get into detail about what the other stuff is. But quite frankly, I think it's more adult to be more like the kids we were than to grow up and be like what culture tells us growing up is supposed to be like. So that's kind of a long aside, but ultimately the point I'm trying to get at here is the way that this kind of unlocks with just one key idea is one of the things that I love about Tolkien. You can read something and be, I'm not sure I understand that. And then you get the one insight, and then everything just like a flower just blooms out, and you see the absolute beauty of it all. And the more you think about it, the more you see. And the more you see, the more you think about it, and it just keeps growing and growing and growing. I love this about Tolkien. And this particular idea itself is a great one. Because, you know, and I'm not even saying that Tolkien necessarily intended in his statements that I've quoted here any of the ideas specifically that I've talked about. But I think all of them are valid connections to that idea, whatever it was that he meant. So, you know, like I said, you could probably go on and on and on about other ways to, you know, unfold this idea and keep getting more and more out of it. But I don't want to make this video too long, so I'll just leave it here for now. And if you have any other ideas about what Tolkien is getting at when it comes to sorrow and wisdom and pity and patience, endurance and hope, and all these other, you know, lovely ideas that he puts in there and never explains, you know, put your ideas in the comments. Tell me if you think I'm off on any of what I've been talking about. And just in general, let's have an interesting conversation about it. Because this is one of those really deep ideas, and this is where Tolkien is, you know, often at his best, is when he's conveying something so deep that you can't even really articulate it in a story without ruining the story. But you plant that little seed there, and it just gets in you, and the next thing you know, it's part of you. So if you did enjoy the video, please do give it a like, share it around. Make sure you click subscribe if you want to catch all of my future content. If you're on YouTube, make sure you click the bell icon so you don't miss any notifications. Check the description below, of course, for social and other links, especially the platform formerly known as Twitter, where I share Tolkien trivia questions, and there's support links and other things as well. Until the next time, I'm the Tolkien Geek, signing out for the Tolkien Lore Channel. Namarie! Thanks to all my channel supporters, especially Elf Friends Paul Leone, Nathan Dufour, and Robert Kindling.